Professor Robert Putnam, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
It's good to be with you, Andrew.
One of the things that comes out in your writing, particularly since you published American Grace, the book about how religion unites and divides the United States, is that you explode a number of myths. And here in Australia, we have this impression of America as a hyper-religious country where religion is extremely conservative and dictates the social and political agenda. But what do you think is the biggest stereotype that is shattered by the research that you and David Campbell have done?
The most startling point is that actually if you talk to individual Americans about people who have different faiths than they do, or even no faith at all, in our private lives, Americans are remarkably tolerant of people across religious lines. It's true that in public, we've been fighting for the last 20 or 30 years about religiously derived issues, above all abortion and homosexuality. But actually, in our private lives, during those very same periods, we've become more and more tolerant across religious lines, including, as I say, the line between being religious and not religious. Most non-religious Americans believe that religion is basically a force for good in America, and most religious Americans believe that you can be a perfectly good America and not have a religious faith. So we're actually, both in our media and in your media, I think the degree to which this polarization has divided our society is exaggerated or at least misstated. There are many, many other myths that we address. For example, white people in America, men and women, are not nearly so religiously involved as people of color. The most highly religious group in America by far are African Americans, and then they're followed by Latinos.
For many of us, the biggest myth was shattered, and that was that white males in the United States are less religious of all the demographic groups.
That's certainly true. They're less religious than women, and they're a lot less religious than men or women of color.
You pose up front in the book this question: how can religious pluralism coexist with religious polarization? How do they achieve that? How does America achieve that?
First of all, you need to set the stage by saying that Americans, by comparison to any other advanced country in the world, are very religious. The average American is slightly more religiously observant than the average Iranian, for example. So we're very religious. And we're also, at least in our public life, divided along religious lines. That's the part of this picture that has, I'm sure, been transmitted across the Pacific. And most places in the world that are deeply devout and deeply divided in religious terms are also characterized by mayhem. Think Northern Ireland or Baghdad or Bombay or Beirut. And yet Americans turn out to be remarkably tolerant, and that's the puzzle. How could we be so tolerant if we take religion seriously and are also divided? And the answer, we think, comes from the fact that in the very same years in which we've become more divided religiously, and at least in terms of our politics, in our private lives, been busy building all sorts of personal ties that cross religious lines. So, that, for example, most marriages in America today, unlike 50 years ago, cross religious lines, what we call interfaith marriages, in which a Catholic marries a Protestant, or a Jew marries a Protestant, or a Mormon marries a Catholic, or somebody who doesn't have any religion at all marrying someone who's devoutly Buddhist or devoutly Catholic or whatever. Those sorts of interfaith marriages are now typical. And what that means is that all of us have likely to have some encounter with people who are of a different religious orientation than we are. About 40% of all Americans have changed their own religious affiliation from that of their parents or from that of their children, and that means in our own families we're divided in religious terms, and moreover, most of us have many close friendships in other religious communities. It's very hard to demonize a group if you love someone who's in that group, as most Americans do. We say in the book...
Yes, you have a story about Aunt Susan, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, Aunt Susan is a mythical or a metaphorical character in the book, but Aunt Susan is a wonderful human being. She's the salt of the earth. She's the person who remembers birthdays and brings chicken soup if you get sick and always is out volunteering. But unfortunately, Aunt Susan is some different faith than you are. You're Catholic and she's Protestant, or you're Protestant and she's Mormon, or you're Mormon and she's Jewish, or whatever. And you know that your faith says, the theology says, poor Aunt Susan, nice lady, not going to make it to heaven. But, I mean, you know, Aunt Susan is a wonderful person. I don't know whether I'm going to heaven, but Aunt Susan for sure is. And you can see all Americans making this kind of, I would say it's a kind of a syllogism. Well, Aunt Susan is going to make it to heaven, therefore maybe other people are too. The astonishing thing is that the overwhelming majority of Americans, 80 or 90% of Americans, say that a good person, not of their faith, can nevertheless go to heaven.
That's correct, and that figure includes evangelical Christians.
Most evangelical Christians in America say that even non-Christians are going to go to heaven. Now, from their point of view, that's the wrong answer. I mean, Jesus was very clear about this. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the light. Except through me, there's no access to the Father. I mean, that's pretty clear. Not a complicated question. And yet most evangelicals, when we ask them, say, yes, even non-Christians, if they're good, are going to be able to make it to heaven. And that, we think, is explicable by Aunt Susan, or by my pal Al. Al and I, Al's a beekeeper, I'm a beekeeper. We go out doing whatever beekeepers do. One day after beekeeping, I learned to my shock that Al is a Mormon. Well, I don't know any other Mormons, and I always was a little prejudiced against Mormons, but I mean, Al's a great guy. So you can see Americans, in effect, saying, well, you know, if Al's a Mormon, maybe Mormons are okay. So these personal networks have bound Americans together and, in a way, integrated American society, even across these lines that otherwise appear pretty deep.
And in fact, if there is a split, I think I recall reading where you say that it's between the faithful and their religious leaders, because the religious leaders believe that if their followers have this rather capacious, inclusive view of who goes to heaven, maybe we haven't done our jobs correctly.
That's right. I had a remarkable experience in which I spoke to the annual meeting of the theologians in the most conservative Christian denomination in America, the Missouri Synod Lutherans, they're called. And when I reported these facts, that even Missouri Synod Lutherans in the pews believe that non-Christians can be saved, there was deep gloom in the audience, because they said, we've been telling them that every day. This is not a complicated question. How did they get it wrong? And the answer, of course, is Aunt Susan.
I'm speaking with the renowned Harvard sociologist, Professor Robert Putnam. Professor Putnam, tell us about the shock and aftershock in America that shook up the religious world. What was that shock?
In the 1950s, Americans were all kind of moderately in the middle. They were not terribly religious, but fairly religious. And then came the first of several shocks, like an earthquake, came the 1960s, and the 1960s divided American society in many ways, as it did other countries in the world, of course. Politically, it was the Vietnam War, and in gender terms, it was the feminist revolution, and in racial terms, it was the civil rights revolution. And there were also major changes in sexual mores. People became much, much more relaxed about, for example, premarital sex. And many, at the same time as those so-called liberating waves were sweeping across America, it was a shock that sent a bunch of younger people off to the more secular end of the spectrum. So you have to imagine an earthquake, and then one side of this split is this growing number of fairly secular Americans, not really atheists, but they've sort of left the sphere of religious influence, and that was fine. They felt good about that. I'm speaking about the 1960s. But then there were another group of Americans, and this was the first aftershock, who in the 1970s and 1980s were appalled by what they saw, not as liberation, but as the collapse of fundamental features of Western morality that had been held to be true for 2,000 years. And they moved off to the more religious end of the spectrum, looking for the part of the religious spectrum that would be most articulate in defending what came to be called family values. And that was the origin of the religious right. So the first shock sent one group of Americans off in a secular direction. The first aftershock sent another group of Americans off to the more religious end of the spectrum, what came to be called the religious right. And that was fine, and they became involved in politics, and that's the part of the story that I think is fairly well known in Australia, that is the rise of the religious right.
Before we get to that, though, Professor, I just want to concentrate a little bit on that shock period, because some of your research is really revealing here. The churches in the 60s, you say, were squeezed between those who felt that they were becoming irrelevant to the new issues of personal and sexual liberation, and another group that thought the churches were trying to be too accommodating. They were squeezed in the middle, weren't they?
Well, squeezed or torn. I mean, in fact, most of them were torn apart, not so much squeezed, but whatever image you use, that's right. That was a conflict that divided America along the line between more religious and more secular people.
And there were two pieces of literature that were particularly influential. One was the famous 1966 Time magazine cover, which asked, "Is God dead?" or declared the death of God. And the other was the classic book by the Harvard theologian Harvey Cox called The Secular City. Why were those two publications so critical?
Well, they caught the spirit of the rapid secularization that went on. It's hard to overstate how rapid was this secularization and, in general, the changes in American society during the 1960s. From the point of view of the average person living through it, it seemed as if almost overnight fundamental changes were occurring in America, and some Americans lauded and rejoiced in those changes. Those were the people who were sort of on the left and became more secular in their orientations. But the same changes were seen on the right as being, as I've said, the end of a major historical era and terrible in their implications for American society. And in a very real sense, American society now, really almost 50 years later, is still fighting about those same issues.
And that period of shock was also when you saw the beginning of the decline of liberal mainline Protestantism and the real growth of evangelical Protestantism. Tell me about that.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, in your metaphor, the mainline Protestant churches, and for that matter, the Catholic Church, was kind of caught in the middle of that divide in American society. And when we say mainline Protestant churches, we mean Methodists and Lutherans and Presbyterians and so on, Congregationalists. And those churches lost membership and church attendance catastrophically from the 1960s on, and they're actually still losing members. At the same time, the same thing was happening for somewhat similar reasons to the Catholic Church. The hierarchy of the church, after a brief interlude with John XXIII, the hierarchy of the church became quite intensely conservative, but the people in the pews in Catholic churches were much more liberal on average, and they flooded away from the church. So now, in America today, of all people who have been raised as Catholics in America, that is, they grew up as Catholics, about two-thirds are no longer practicing Catholics. About one-third no longer even say they're Catholic at all, and another third, well, they say they're Catholics, but that's more a sort of a culinary or ethnic statement. They never go to church and they never go to Mass. They never take part in any of the rites of the church. So the Catholic Church, just like the mainline Protestant churches, was ripped asunder, basically, by the events of the 60s and into the early 70s. And conversely, as the conservative reaction against the 60s began to roil the society, that aftershock showed up in growing numbers of people being attached to the evangelical Protestant churches.
And there's a lovely statistic that you quote there that is quite indicative, and that is about the number of staff that were employed by the Campus Crusade for Christ, which I think grew from about 100 to more than 6,500. And that was rather indicative of that blossoming of evangelicalism.
It's true. And the evangelicals came to be, and in many ways still are, the most visible, I would say, the public face of religion entirely in America now has this face of the evangelicals. And it's great for the evangelicals, but for the rest of the country, especially the political views and the conservatism of that group, has triggered now more recently this second aftershock, which is driving many younger people entirely away from religion at all. I mean, from all forms of religion.
I just want to concentrate for a moment on that evangelical growth, because it demonstrates another way in which your research shatters a myth, and that is that by the early 70s, the evangelical Christians were becoming more educated. They were no longer the sort of dirt poor, poorly educated people who lived in rural America. Evangelicalism was growing as a middle-class, white-collar, educated force.
Absolutely right. That's exactly where the growth of evangelicalism has been. It's been in middle-class or upper-middle-class white suburbs above all. Now, of course, anytime you're generalizing about a group that has millions of members, I don't mean that all of them are in that category, but that was the category that grew the most rapidly during the 70s and 80s. It's important to understand the rise of evangelicalism, which began in the 1970s, ended by 1990. I know that's not the way it's seen in the public press, but the data are perfectly clear. The rise of evangelicalism occurred between 1970 and 1990 and then ended.
Oh, yes, you say quite explicitly it is a feature of the past, not of the present.
That's correct.
One of the other really fascinating points that you make, though, about evangelicalism is that evangelicals became much more proud. It used to be that evangelicals who made it into the middle class, you say, used to convert. Baptists would become Presbyterians or Lutherans, but by the 70s, no, they were sticking with evangelicalism.
That's right. It used to be that working class Baptists, as they moved up the ladder, would become, you know, Episcopalians or at least Methodists, just as they were trading in their Chevys for Buicks or Cadillacs. But that stopped, and many of those upwardly mobile folks during the 70s and 80s stayed with the evangelical church of their forefathers.
And as evangelicalism became more sophisticated, if I can put it like that, was there a drop-off in biblical literalism?
There was. That's been going on for some time. It's quite clear from the evidence in our book and other people's research that the overwhelming factor behind that is the growth of college education. As college education spread across the United States, biblical literalism, that is believing that the Bible is in every word true beyond doubt, that view among college educated people of all denominations has faded.
I'm speaking with Professor Robert Putnam. He is the author in the 1990s of the famous essay and then book Bowling Alone, and more recently with David Campbell, he is the author of the book American Grace: How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Professor, let's speak now about this second aftershock, which we're still feeling. This began, I think, in the early 1990s. You referred to it. This was the kind of counter-reaction to the counter-reaction.
That's exactly right. As the evangelicals and religious conservatives began to become more powerful and more assertive publicly in their involvement in politics, more and more, and as political conservatism, especially about issues of abortion and homosexuality, became, in a way, the calling card of religion in America, a new generation of Americans coming of age in the 1990s and then into the 21st century began to say to themselves, well, if religion is just about being conservative and being Republican, being a member of the Republican Party and you know, hostile to homosexuals and so on, that's not me. I'm out of here. And there has been a extremely rapid growth in a category that sociologists in America call the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not Catholic sisters, but the people who say, when you ask them what religion they have, they say they have none. They have no religious affiliation. And that number, which historically was about 5 to 7% of Americans, just in the course of the last two decades has risen. Among younger Americans, that's risen to about 33-35%. So it's an incredibly rapid change. It's important to understand a couple of things about the growth of this, what are sometimes called the young nuns. One, most of them are not atheists. These are not people who've been convinced by the new atheism, so-called, of Dawkins and others. Most of them say they believe in God. Most of them were raised in religious homes. Many of them still pray. Some of them say that religion is an important part of their lives, but they are very alienated from organized religion. That's the crucial thing. Secondly, although this looks a little superficially like the century-long process of secularization in Western Europe and perhaps also in Australia, the structure of this change in America is quite different. It's not been going on as it has in England, say, for, you know, a percentage point or two every decade for more than 100 years. In America, it's all happened in the last 20 years, and it's entirely concentrated among people. There's one factor that distinguishes the young nuns from the people who have stayed in church, and that is they're really upset about mixing politics and religion. So just as the evangelicals were reacting against the 60s, so this young secular group is reacting against the 70s and 80s and reacting against the religious right. And that reaction is continuing to grow. We just last summer did another national survey in America, and we could see many of the same people that we had talked to ourselves 4 or 5 years earlier and who then said they were Methodist or Catholic or Baptist or whatever, now calling themselves nun out of alienation from the political activities of organized religion.
Yes, you say that for many young people, and indeed for many religious people, they sat out those culture wars of the 1990s, of the Clinton era. I lived for several years in the United States in the mid-90s, and I recall that the 1990s being characterized by the vicious culture wars, beginning, I think, in 1992, really, when Pat Buchanan at the Republican National Convention declared, "We are in a war for the culture or a war for religion in this country."
Yes, and the people that we're talking about now, these young people who become more secular, are exactly the people who would otherwise have been in church. These are not people who've been hostile to religion per se, but they in effect said, if all we're going to do in religion is just get angry over these political issues, and especially if religion is just about homophobia, that's not me. If that's what it means to be religious, then I must not be religious. And this all occurred just in the period in which American young people and younger generations in general in the United States were becoming much more open-minded or tolerant, I would say, of people who are homosexual. And so younger Americans were zigging to the left on issues of homosexuality exactly in the same years that the religious leadership of the country was zagging to the right. And the young people didn't follow those leaders. They just turned left and kept going. And it's clear now, even to evangelical leaders, I've spoken to a lot of evangelical leaders, it's clear now that evangelicalism and indeed religion in America is paying a huge price for having gotten too close, in an organizational way, too close to politics.
And that seems to be reflected in the attitudes of people like Rick Warren, a mega church pastor who has books that sell in the tens of millions, and yet he does not want to be, it seems, the kind of religious leader that Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson was in the 1980s.
That's exactly right. And he is the poster boy, I would say, for this younger generation of evangelical leaders who recognize with horror that they made, and you'll excuse the expression, a bargain with the devil when they got too close to politics, and they want to get out of that bargain. Many of these evangelical leaders, like Rick Warren, they are in the business of saving souls. They're not in the business of politics. And in our most recent surveys, we see this through the eyes of the people sitting in the pews, that the number of religious sermons in America over the last 5 years has been cut in half. Why are most religious leaders talking less about politics or social issues in church? Because they're kind of like businessmen or entrepreneurs. They want to have people in the pews, and if the constant harping on right-wing politics is driving people away, as it is, well, it's more important to them to get back to the basics of religion. And that, I think, is what we're probably in the midst of seeing that. It's not yet shown up in public opinion polls, but that's exactly what I expect to be happening. In short, I think this period that began with the 60s and that is now, I think, in its twilight will, in historical terms, be seen as a kind of parenthesis in American history. Americans have always been unusually religious from the very beginning. And our views about social issues, have often been linked to our religion, mostly, I have to say, on the left, not on the right. Most of the major progressive or left-wing social movements in American history have come out of churches. The abolition movement, which ended slavery in the 19th century, was a direct consequence of an evangelical revival in the 1830s and 1840s. The Civil Rights Revolution came directly out of churches, black and white. This period that we're just ending, in which God seemed to be only a Republican, is a very unusual period that organizational ties between some of these leaders of evangelical churches and some Republican politicians have become extremely close, way too close for comfort. And the price is now being paid both by religious leaders who are seeing their flocks graying as young people don't show up, and I have to say, I think it's very likely that the Republican Party, too, will pay a price for continuing to harp on these older so-called social or family values issues.
Professor, in the time that we have left, I want to discuss a couple of issues that seem to be really critical, though, in the continuing political dialogue. Right. In your research, you found two fascinating statistics: that young people are becoming more conservative, if you like, on this question of abortion, more conservative than their baby boomer parents, much more like their grandparents, but much more liberal on the question of sexuality. How do we square these two seemingly contradictory trends?
Well, that's exactly what's happening, and the data are quite clear. This is not a matter on which there's a lot of debate about what the facts are. Explaining the facts is another matter. The homosexuality trend is, I think, and most people think, driven largely by the fact that as gay people have come out of the closet, it turns out Aunt Susan is not only of the other religion, but Aunt Susan is gay. And, you know, once you've learned that Aunt Susan or your pal Al is gay, it's hard to be really so homophobic. And
that Aunt Susan's bridge partner is really her girlfriend.
Exactly. As those changes have swept over American society, the level of tolerance across this gay-straight line in America is growing extremely rapidly. I mean, it's just, you can see it year by year. I don't mean people are becoming themselves more homosexual, but I do mean they're becoming much more live and let live. It's your business what your sexual orientation is. Abortion has a slightly different flavor, has come to have a slightly different flavor in America, and that is, this younger generation sees abortion as a more morally complicated issue. I don't mean that they're completely hostile to the idea of abortion. They don't, for example, favor overturning the famous court case that made abortion legal in America, so-called Roe v. Wade decision. But whereas their baby boomer mothers and fathers were apt to see abortion as, in effect, another form of birth control, the younger generation, I think, and I'm reading now into the, trying to explain the patterns in the data, I think they think, no, it's not quite so simple as that, because there is another life or another person or would-be, could-be person, that is the infant, the fetus, and that life has also somehow to be taken into account.
Yes, and you say in the book, you illustrate it wonderfully with the example of young parents these days emailing pictures of their ultrasound around, and that
right.
the figure in the ultrasound is not a fetus, that is a baby-to-be, that is my baby.
That is widely felt, even by people who ideologically might be on the so-called pro-choice side. So the way to read the movement among younger people is not that it's a lurch back to the far right on the issue of abortion. The way to read it is it's a movement toward the muddled middle, which says, and this is, I'm now quoting Bill Clinton, but this is absolutely the middle of the American position on this, that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And that sort of motto, which recognizes that abortion is not just like, you know, having your toenails filed, is becoming more characteristic of younger Americans.
And because, in your words, quote, in the trend towards more cultural liberalism, abortion stands as an outlier, you think that abortion may eventually fade as a decisive political issue in America?
Yeah, we think that both of these issues, but for very different reasons, both homosexuality and abortion are likely to move kind of off the agenda abortion because Americans are sort of gathering, especially younger Americans, gathering in the middle of that position, and it's no longer going to be quite, we think, quite so divisive. The middle meaning people who are saying, yes, sure, okay, but, you know, on the other hand, that kind of one-hand, other-hand position is now the dominant position among younger people, and therefore there's not likely to be an incentive to politicize it. And on homosexuality, the trend is also likely to move the issue off the agenda, but for very different reasons. Namely, all Americans, gay, straight, Republican, Democratic, younger, and even some older, liberal and conservatives, are rapidly coming to terms with and making peace with the issue of homosexuality, and that's just not going to be a hot-button issue anymore. Indeed, the trends there are so sharp that I think now to be decisively anti-homosexual, for example, opposed to gay marriage in America, is becoming an electoral liability.
You're with the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, and I'm talking with the famous American political scientist, Professor Robert Putnam, about his book, along with that of David E. Campbell, called American Grace: How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Finally, Professor Putnam, you are most famous in the 1990s for your book Bowling Alone, in which you talked about the decline of social capital in America, the fewer people who were taking part in communal sports teams, in service clubs, the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club. Where does religion fit in the social capital agenda? Beyond the questions of faith and divinity, etc., where does it fit as a community-building function?
It's probably still today the single most important source of, in my jargon, social capital or social connecting in America. Half of all volunteering in America is religious, half of all philanthropy is religious, half of all group memberships in America are religious. And what we found in this study is that, quite remarkably, religious people are, on average, better friends, better neighbors, and better citizens. We sometimes say loosely and with our tongue slightly in our cheek, religious people seem to be just nicer than other people. When we compare matched people, the people of the same gender and the same age and the same part of the country and the same education level and the same size of town and so on, one of whom is more religious, the other of whom is less religious, the more religious person uniformly is more likely to volunteer, more likely to give to charity and not just put money in the church plate on Sunday, but also to give more money to secular causes. Religious people give more money to and volunteer more for secular causes than secular people do. Religious people are two or three times more likely to work on community projects, on working with their neighbors to fix up the neighborhood. Religious people are more likely to give blood. They're more likely to give money to a homeless person on the street. They're more likely to be involved in civic life and political life. And on the left as well as on the right, they're more likely to be involved. One of the questions we asked was, what happens if somebody cuts in front of you in line in a queue? Now, that probably never would happen in Australia.
You have a rose-colored view of Australia, Robert, but anyway.
Well, it turns out that religious people are more likely to let someone cut in front of them without, you know, shooting them down. So if you are driving in America and you do want to cut in front of somebody, you ought to be sure it's a churchgoer in front of whom you're cutting.
Well, you'll see that little fish symbol or maybe a cross hanging from their rear vision mirror. The other interesting point to make, and I think it's really relevant in today's wired world where we're all attached to our computer screens, and in many ways we've become a lot more insular, you point out that religious people in America, of all faiths, tend to be more socially networked. They get out more. They will knock on the door of the old person across the road to make sure that he or she is okay.
That's right. And we spent a lot of time, Andrew, trying to figure out, well, why are religious people in all these ways so much better neighbors and better citizens and so on? And we thought at first it might have something to do with theology. Maybe people who believed in hell were working hard to kind of avoid it and therefore trying to be nice. Or maybe people who believed in heaven hoped that they could get a leg up on getting to heaven in the next life. Or maybe, but we thought it might depend upon belief in God, an angry God or a loving God. So we asked a couple dozen questions about people's theology And it turned out none of that mattered at all. It doesn't matter what people's beliefs are as long as they're going to church, and in particular, as long as they are involved in social networks in their own religious church or congregation. The variable, and when we began analyzing the data, we came to call it church friends. The more church friends, the more friends you have at church, the nicer you are. And that is such a powerful relationship. It's a very, very strong relationship. Of course, having friends in general is associated with being a good neighbor and being a good citizen and so on, but church friends are kind of supercharged. The more church friends, or that is friends in your religious congregation that you have, you're a lot nicer with each additional church friend. And so strong is this relationship that if you have friends at church but are an atheist, now you might say, come on, Bob, how could an atheist have friends at church? And the answer is through your spouse. That is, maybe you don't believe in God, but your spouse does, so you go along to church on Sundays, you go to a few church suppers, you've got some friends in that church, even though you're not a believer. It turns out that if you've got friends at church, no matter what your beliefs, your behavior is nicer. Those church friends have somehow induced you to be nicer. And conversely, if you are deeply devout and all you think about is religion and God is constantly on your mind and you even go to church every Sunday, but you sit alone in the pews and you don't have any friends at church, turns out you're not any nicer than the most secular person. It's the church social networks, church friends, that induce this remarkably more altruistic behavior of religious people. We don't yet quite understand why church friends are so powerful in inducing us to behave well. But in the earlier book about social isolation in general, we said that Americans were bowling alone and that bowling in leagues, that is, bowling in teams, bowling where you saw other people, it was a metaphor, was better for you, your own life, better for your community, and so on. And this new research, in effect, says, yes, bowling in leagues is good, but bowling in church leagues, that's the real ticket.
Well, Professor Robert Putnam, it has been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for being generous with your time for us here on the Religion and Ethics Report. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
It's a great pleasure.